Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Big, bold, progressive. Those are some of the words Massachusetts Senator Ed Markey uses to describe President Joe Biden's agenda, as the president laid it out last night before a joint session of Congress. It was President Biden's first major address to Congress, and as with everything these days, the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic was clear. Instead of a standing room only venue packed with more than 1,000 people, only a couple of hundred folks were in the room, all wearing masks, and many members of Congress and invited guests were forced to watch the address remotely. Senator Markey, however, was one of those lucky enough to be in attendance last night, so we caught up with him earlier this afternoon to talk about what he heard from the president, what he makes of the administration's priorities moving forward, and what it was like to be in the room where it happened.
It was obviously a reflection of the times, you know, with the COVID protections in place. Each one of us had three seats between us. I was sitting up in the gallery with Elizabeth Warren, but three seats away. But ultimately, this address by the president each year is to the American people, to the people who are watching. And so to the members of Congress who couldn't get seats, I was lucky enough to get one. We're sorry, but ultimately it was the people sitting at home in their kitchens and their living rooms watching last night. And I think for many of the people in Massachusetts, I think they probably enjoyed this speech a lot more than they enjoyed Donald Trump's speech last year. And perhaps next year we can go back to business as usual, although we'll just wait and see what the science allows us to do.
What do you think the key takeaway was for all those Massachusetts watchers in their kitchens and living rooms?
Well, I think it was a Massachusetts directed speech. He talked about education. He talked about healthcare. He talked about innovation. He talked about the future. He talked about America taking on China, being competitive with China, having a plan to take on China. So I think the parts of the president's speech where he was saying we need to have 2 years of free pre-K, we need 2 years of free community college, he was just saying that it's not 1900 anymore. High school enough is not enough. We have to adjust to the world as it is in the 21st century. And I think on education, on child leave, on expanded healthcare benefits, all of those issues go right to the heart of the modern economy and what we have to do to adjust to deal with it. And when he spoke about climate change, we're not just the Bay State, we're the brain state in Massachusetts, and we believe in science and we believe in the need to have to deal with the consequences of the climate crisis. And then the answer is creating millions of new jobs, blue collar jobs, as the president said last night, a blue collar revolution to be able to solve this problem and export the technologies overseas. So I think from a Massachusetts perspective, it was a home run.
What does that look like for a blue-collar worker in Massachusetts? I mean, the president, for those listeners who didn't hear the speech last night, he was very clear in his connection between his approach to climate and American jobs. What does that mean for blue-collar workers in Massachusetts?
Well, you just start with offshore wind. The first 800 megawatts has now been green-lighted by the Department of Interior. And so we're in a situation where on that one project alone, there are 500 blue collar jobs that are going to be there for workers in Massachusetts. But as you know, the state of Massachusetts has also authorized thousands of additional megawatts of wind to be deployed. And the president has set a very ambitious goal of 30,000 megawatts off of the Atlantic coast by the year 2030. So for Massachusetts, that means potentially upwards of 5,000 to 10,000 new blue-collar jobs just in the offshore wind industry. So when the president said jobs, 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 blue-collar jobs, blue-collar jobs, blue-collar jobs, he's really talking about solving the climate crisis.
All right, so let's stay with the what the president said government is going to do last night. You know, $2 trillion on infrastructure, almost $2 trillion for education, childcare, and healthcare in the American Families Plan. There's been a $2 trillion pandemic relief package. This sounds like a vision of big government openly embraced by the Biden administration. Is that fair?
Well, I think it's fair to say that we haven't seen a time like this since the 1930s, and we're in our own FDR moment. We're in our own Great Depression, combined with, by the way, the 1918 pandemic, the flu crisis of 1918. And I might add as well, we're kind of hearkening back to 1967, 68 in terms of racial issues once again percolating up to the top of our national agenda. So it's a time of a need for a great historic response to the problems. And I think that's what Joe Biden stepped up last night and delivered for the American people. And in the same way that FDR was told it was going to be too big, too bold, too much by more conservative forces, history has proven him to be right and his critics to be wrong. I think the same thing is true with regard to this bold set of programs that Joe Biden has proposed for our country.
So one of the things that I noticed in listening to that agenda laid out last night, I found myself wondering, what's the vision of the private sector that this agenda communicates? Clearly, taxation to pay for this agenda. But it sounded like a stipulation that the private sector isn't going to handle some of these key items, infrastructure, working class jobs, health care, and that therefore the government will. Is this a shifting in who we see as responsible for the social contract that was laid out last night?
Well, I would say there are certain areas where obviously the government is going to play a significant role. But in terms of the employment of Americans, especially blue-collar workers, in solving problems, no, that's going to be private sector as well. So, for example, the president inserted into his infrastructure bill a $25 billion climate bank, which for every dollar the federal government invests, will unleash at least $7 of private sector investment. And the private sector needs a little bit of leverage from the federal government. But according to analysts looking at the economic results of having a climate bank, and I'm very confident that my proposal will ultimately become law, could potentially, if we can fund it up to $100 billion, create 4 million new jobs, mostly blue collar, over the next 4 years to solve the climate crisis. So I had a hearing yesterday. I'm the chair of the Climate and Clean Air Subcommittee, and I had a subcommittee hearing yesterday on this issue of a climate bank. And I will tell you, ultimately, I think it has tremendous potential for getting support on a bipartisan basis because it does unleash the potential of the private sector.
Okay, so I'm zeroing in on the tremendous potential for bipartisan support, which you can forgive an outside observer from saying, how is there potential for anything to have bipartisan support right now? For, you know, outside observers might see this as one of the most partisan times in Congress's history. How do you take steps forward to get a bill of that magnitude passed in this moment in Congress?
Well, I think you're right. I think that if passed as prologue, if what the Republicans did to Bill Clinton, the Republicans did to Barack Obama tells us anything, it's to just take advantage of the first 2 years of the president's term of office. So my view is we have to try to negotiate with the Republicans, but we have to put it on the clock. We have to say there's going to be a limit. We're not going to allow you to run out this whole year because we have to get big things done and get big things done now. And so to the extent to which the great Broadway play Waiting for Godot is relevant here. As we know, Godot never showed up on stage. And the same thing could be true for Republicans in terms of providing bipartisan votes for these big packages. And if that's the case, then the Democrats have to move forward without them. And to pass it with 50 votes and having Kamala Harris break the tie. And ultimately, if necessary, we have to repeal the filibuster so that on all these big issues, we don't have to be dependent upon 10 Republicans to cross the line when so many of them are avowedly committed to ensuring that nothing that is progressive becomes a law during the Biden years.
You just talked about 50 votes. $15 minimum wage didn't get all the votes on the Democratic side. How do you keep Democrats together when the spending bills are this big in order to get to the point where a vice president could break a tie?
Well, it's going to be a lot of work, a lot of hard work to listen to first Republicans. And then if they say no, that ultimately we have to work with all of the Democrats in our caucus, including Joe Manchin, with whom I've been speaking, to try to find common ground so that we can do these big things for our country. I think that what the president was speaking about last night goes right to the heart of the blue collar revolution that will be helpful to West Virginia, but also to every other state. And that's going to be our job.
West Virginia being Joe Manchin's state.
West Virginia being where Senator Joe Manchin is from, yes. So I think that we will have to work very hard, but ultimately I think we can be successful in keeping our Democratic coalition together.
You talked about putting a clock behind this. I also wonder if there's a ticking clock towards 2022 that is adding urgency to this agenda while there is a 50, you know, vote count in the Senate and without losing potentially additional seats in the House. How much are you feeling that sense of a ticking clock in trying to move this agenda forward?
I think that the politics of 2022 are going to be much improved if we've passed the earned income tax credit, if we've extended child tax credits, if we've put family leave on the books, if we've already created 4 million new blue collar jobs towards the goal of solving the climate crisis. So we've got a race against time. We have to prove that our theory is correct in terms of what will make America work better. And the sooner we get the laws on the books is the sooner the voter in 2022 can say, they made a promise, they delivered, let's keep them in office. So that's always a challenge in politics, but I think that the pace at which Joe Biden has been moving so far, thinking big, thinking bold, but also thinking that it's important to move with great political speed in the same way FDR did in 1933 is central to us holding on to the House and Senate in 2022.
I want to turn for a moment to less of a policy and more of a personal dimension to last night. I was struck in watching both President Biden and then Senator Tim Scott's response that there were tensions. There was disagreement, but there were also some common human themes. You know, watching President Biden acknowledging Mitch McConnell for naming a piece of legislation dealing with cancer after his son, Beau. And then some of the resonance of the notes from Senator Tim Scott. Here's a little bit of his message on being one family.
Our best future will not come from Washington schemes or socialist dreams. It will come from you, the American people. Black, Hispanic, white, and Asian, Republican and Democrat, brave police officers in Black neighborhoods. We are not adversaries. We are family.
I felt like I heard some of those same messages from the president, and both of those tones are remarkable compared to the tone of 2 years ago, let's say. Is there something starting to emerge here to build on and bring us back to a sense of shared commitment as Americans?
Well, I can only hope so. China believes they're going to win, if that's the word, because they're homogeneous. We only win when we recognize that what makes America great is our heterogeneity. And in order to be the dominant political, economic, moral force in the world in the 21st century, we have to be more like us. That's who we have to be. And so to the extent to which we are a family and we understand that everyone is part of that family, that's what the president's programs are all about. It's making sure that every one of those family members, regardless of race, regardless of country or origin, are given a way so that they can fully participate in the American dream. And my hope is that as we move forward, that those on the other side of the aisle recognize that it was the Black and brown, poor and immigrant communities that were the essential workers over the last year who took the risks for our families, but it was their families that ultimately were exposed to the coronavirus, and that it's reflected in the policies, healthcare, education, racial, climate, economic justice, that we put on the books in order to reflect the fact that we are a family. And a big part of our family took a big risk for all the rest of us who could Zoom to work. And that if we recognize that, then we recognize what makes us great and what will make it very difficult for China to ever surpass us.
That is Massachusetts Senator Ed Markey. Senator Markey, thanks for taking the time today.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me on.
According to the city of Boston, it had more than 55,000 housing units restricted for low-income renters at the end of 2020. That's affordable housing. And a recent WBUR poll shows that housing costs are on the short list of critical issues for Boston voters. But one Boston nonprofit, Tenants Development Corporation, or TDC, has had to go to court to try to protect some affordable housing units. Okay, TDC manages several low-income historic brownstones in the South End. They participated in a federal housing program to upgrade those units, partnering with a private investor through this federal program. TDC got money. The private investor got tax credits, and at the end of the deal, TDC was supposed to be able to buy the units so they could manage them as affordable in perpetuity. But a new investor in the partnership wants to cash in on the properties. WBUR's investigative team has found that this is a common practice for firms around the country, and senior investigative editor and reporter Christine Willemsen joins us now to talk more about it. Christine, welcome back.
Hi, Tiziana. How are you?
Great. Thanks, Christine. This is interesting. Tell us about TDC and how this dispute has unfolded.
Well, TDC is home to tenants like Charles Clark. He landed one of these apartments when he was really young. He was a musician just starting out. Now he's the president of TDC's tenant-run board in the South End, where it's really expensive to live.
I've been living here. This will be my 40th year living at TDC. This is ours. And look how good we keep this building. This is why we're so proud. Nice little garden over there. We take care of all of that.
As you can see, residents really care about their properties in the South End, including this group. And so I'm going to talk a little bit about the key players. Obviously, TDC is one, but another key player, which most people have never heard of, is Alden Torch Financial. It's an investment firm out of Denver, and they bought the interest in the partnership with TDC several years ago, back in 2011, I think. When the tax credits expired, that 15 years, TDC thought it had the option or the right to buy it according to the agreement, but Alden Torch is preventing the nonprofit from acquiring it, and now it's being fought in federal and state court.
So, Christine, Alden Torch Financial, this is sort of like when a company owns a mortgage and they sell it to another company. They bought basically the private side of this partnership from somebody else to get the remainder of the tax credits. Is that right?
Yes, that's absolutely right. There's a second investor that's coming in after the tax credits have expired in around 10 years. And they're coming in and they have other ideas of how they want to maximize profits. And it's not through tax credits at that point. Here's Bill Bronner. He's a Boston housing specialist. This is what he had to say.
These economic investors are, in fact, exploiting a loophole. There's no indication that when the tax credit program was established, there was any thought that this could happen.
Okay, so I have some questions about what changed, but before I ask that, let me just ask one other clarifying question to you. This is not the way the federal program was designed to work. Let me just be clear about that. Is that right?
Yeah, so the intent of Congress way back in the 80s was to get an infusion of cash so nonprofits could build or upgrade housing. And then the idea was to keep it affordable for a very long time and even keep it in local community hands. That was the idea. But now there's this whole new level of investors that have come in, and they're challenging these housing groups, and they're challenging them specifically in places where real estate has just skyrocketed, you know, Boston, New York, Miami, Seattle. And so the firms are looking to wrest cash and control away from the nonprofit and developers as well. And then they're attempting to even oust the managers from the partnerships. And what that means, if they do that, they can take total control of the property. Other cases we found they were forcing the sale of the property to maximize profits, as they were trying in Boston.
Okay, so how common is this practice?
Housing specialists say it's a growing problem. Some investment firms start to pressure these nonprofits right around the 15-year mark and demand cash, and some are paying it. In those cases, we don't even know about them because they're not reaching the courts. So it's unclear just how prevalent this is. But keep in mind, in Massachusetts alone, in the next 4 years, there's going to be 81 properties affecting 5,000 residents where the tax credits are going to be expiring. And who knows what's going to happen in those cases?
Because then this can come up for grabs as to whether the nonprofit can buy the property and hold it in perpetuity and manage it affordably, or an investor can try to take money out, basically. Is that right?
Absolutely. What it has to do with is that investor going to go away quietly and allow that nonprofit to acquire it, or are they going to poke holes in a contract and try and take it over and put it on the open market, let's say, and fetch millions of dollars?
Okay, so Christine, stick with us. I want to bring a second voice in here. David Davenport is the lawyer representing TDC in this case. He joins us now. David, thank you for joining us on Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me.
And David, now that we're getting your perspective as a lawyer in this case, I want to note we reached out to the lawyers representing Alden Torch Financial as well, and they did not respond to us. So, David, you've been working on a lot of these cases in the past several years. How did we get here to this point where companies are seeking to basically change the intended outcome of a federal program after having gotten the tax credits from that program?
Well, you know, it's really unfortunate. And I think, you know, the reality of it is that, you know, our country is filled with smart people and people who look for loopholes, look for opportunities to come in and try to monetize things that nobody ever had an intention of monetizing. It's certainly not the intent of the program. It's certainly not the intent of the deals that were done. But they've come in essentially with a private equity, Wall Street type mentality. And essentially, as you noted, bought interests in partnerships. They bought paper rights. They stepped into limited partner shoes. They stepped into contracts. And then they come in with massive amounts of resources. They hire big, huge law firms, throw lots of lawyers at it, and frankly, oftentimes just overwhelm their counterparts. We're fortunate and we're blessed that TDC is not going to allow that to happen. But we have clients all over the country, not just nonprofit sponsors of affordable housing like TDC, but the majority of these deals, these affordable deals that are done throughout the country, are oftentimes done by traditional real estate developers who are not nonprofit organizations and who are bringing to bear millions of units of affordable housing. And they are getting the same treatment by these organizations all over the country.
Okay, so David, let's step back from the law for a second and let me just ask, how does TDC get harmed in this? I'm not saying that they don't, but where's the harm? Who gets hurt and how do they get hurt on a practical basis?
On a practical, real-life basis, who gets hurt? Charles Clark, Charles Clark's children, Charles Clark's grandchildren, everybody that
lives in that community. Because they get forced out?
They don't necessarily get... they don't necessarily get forced out, but the community is deprived of an opportunity to access capital. So if you think about the real estate values in the south end of Boston, we'll just use that as an example. They have skyrocketed, as you've noticed, as you noted. And so at the end of the 15th year, when that investor leaves, as they should have, now TDC owns the property. They own full access to that capital. And you know what they can do? They can leverage that capital. They can borrow against it. They can build community centers. They can improve properties. They can buy computers for kids before, after school. You name it. It's a mission-based organization. And that's why Congress did this. Give mission-based opportunities to communities in need across the country. And we know we need it. We know we need it in communities of color.
I apologize. No, that's fine.
No, that's okay. Go ahead, Christine.
No, I just wanted to make a note that there are serious on the ground implications right now. I mean, TDC had planned on doing some renovations. They've had to hold off on that. They planned on building a community center. They're on hold with that. And I think they believe they're going to have to spend about $500,000 in legal fees, too. Here's Clark again from TDC. This is what he has to say.
I mean, it's not just an apartment. It's my home. It's a home. You know, greed is all around us, but we're not going to let that greed destroy what we worked so hard to build all these years.
Okay, and so, David, as I understand it, the law is a little varied and unclear here. Briefly, how is Alden Torch Financial, in your eyes, acting? How are they breaking the law here?
So from my perspective, I don't believe the law is unclear. I think that's a narrative that gets created by Alden Torch Financial and these others like them in the industry, which we often refer to as aggregators. I think they come in and create this narrative to make people believe that the law is unclear. It would be nice if we could get Congress to provide some clarifying language around the right of first refusal, and there are policy efforts underway being led by the National Housing Trust and others. It would be nice to get some clarifying language from Congress, but ultimately at the end of the day, we're in court and we're fighting over contract language. What does it say? How should it be interpreted? And it should be interpreted based on black letter law to give effect and meaning to the intent of the parties. And this was never the intent. And if you just think about it, this is a tax credit investment designed to create tax benefits. It's not designed to create some huge cash windfall for that investor at the end of the 15th year. Because you know what that does? It produces a huge tax obligation. But when you have somebody like Alden Torch, they're not trying to get those tax benefits.
Okay, cool. So now, Christine, how is Alden Torch responding?
Well, the federal judge in Boston, he dismissed the case and said it belonged in state court, but Alden Torch is appealing. So what that means is it could drag on for years, honestly. And for the story, we found out that they really believe TDC's plan to purchase the property, which TDC thought they could purchase it for around $17 million. They believe it was unauthorized, and it believes it could fetch as much as $54 million on the open market. Here's Eric Pettit. He's an attorney with Alden Torch who took a similar case in Seattle. In this case, they claimed the woman that was managing the low-income properties in the Seattle area, that she should be ousted in part for not spending enough on, I'm sorry, for not spending enough or spending too much, I'm sorry, on repairs and not raising rents enough. Here he is.
Obviously, the general partner has to incur expenses in managing the property. But when the purpose of the expense is to benefit itself and to enrich itself, then it's acting outside of its fiduciary duties to the partnership.
Yeah, Alden Torch lost that argument, by the way.
Okay, so I'm going to stay with you for a second longer, Christine. I think you have an example of how this has played out elsewhere that can illustrate or underscore what the worst case could look like for TDC here. Can you just spell that out for us?
I think Dave should take that question.
Okay, so worst case scenario for TDC, Dave.
Worst case scenario, we lose the case. They lose property that they, as an organization, a tenant-based organization, first came to own roughly 50 years ago as an offshoot of the civil rights movement. Worst case scenario is they lose control ownership of those homes. And then that is a kind of tumbling effect, if you will. Now they won't have access to provide the services anymore. They won't have access to the capital they need. That would be the worst case scenario.
All right, so Christine, yeah, go ahead.
Sure, yeah. I mean, I wanted to also provide an example of this all the way across the country in Bellevue, Washington. There's this low-income senior housing complex. It's located downtown among these pricey condos, and it's near Amazon and Microsoft. So the property, it's called Ashwood Court, and it's managed by a nonprofit called Dash. And we walked through the garage of it with the executive director, that's Kim Lovell Price, and she showed me a thing that's called the sharing shelves. And this is where tenants share food and home goods. Tiziana, in this case, Dash had to borrow $300,000 to pay a Boston investment firm. I don't know if you're familiar with it. It's called Boston Financial Investment Management. They had to pay that to exit the partnership. Here's Lovell Price.
You know, I get emotional when we go down to the sharing shelves, right? Because I literally walked by them the day that I had to write that check. There was a half a jar of gravy and a half a head of lettuce.
So, Christine, jump into the end here. What are you going to follow now? What are you looking for next?
Well, I think a lot of people are saying that Congress needs to clarify the language or help out at this point because there's been such a patchwork of rulings. One of the things that we're going to watch, and by the way, just to let you know, that all these firms, they deny any wrongdoing in these cases that we highlighted in our investigation. But we are going to be tracking Washington State. And the reason I say that is they're actually trying to do something about it. They passed some regulations to stop what they call, you know, a threat to low-income housing. And the reason we're going to watch it is because Alden Torch actually sued Washington State and those housing commissioners.
Okay, that is WBUR Senior Investigative Editor and Reporter Christine Wilmson and David Davenport, the lawyer representing TDC. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
If you have had a kid in the last 3 decades, then you definitely know Melissa Bernstein. She, along with her husband, Doug, founded the New England-based toy company, Melissa and Doug, in the 80s in their basement. Since then, they've had wild success selling classic, wholesome, colorful kids' toys, all designed by Melissa. It is now a $500 million company. But while the toys she designed brought so much joy and happiness to millions of kids, Melissa has long suffered with anxiety and depression. As their company grew more successful, Melissa sunk deeper into a dark despair, struggling alone. Now she's opening up about that struggle. She's out with a new memoir and, together with Doug, has launched a new company, Lifelines. It's an online community for people struggling with mental health, totally free, that features a podcast series and a video series with talks and events. Melissa joins us now. Melissa Bernstein, welcome to Radio Boston.
Hi, Tiziana. Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks for coming, Melissa, and for sharing your story. I know that costs a person something to do that, and I want to dig into it. I also want to invite our listeners to join us. Listeners, share your own experiences with anxiety and depression, especially where have you gotten support that helped you, or where do you wish you had gotten support? The number 800-423-8255, that's 1-800-423-TALK. Melissa, when did you know that a part of you, that you're being, while you were sending so much joy out into the world, also had this deep darkness? I think you've called it existential depression.
Yes, exactly. I mean, you know, my mother says that I was born with it because I screamed 24/7 for the first year of my life. But I think from the moment I could perceive feeling and perceive thoughts, you know, I had these three questions in my mind that never left. Why am I here? What is the meaning of life if I am ultimately going to expire? And what am I supposed to do during my brief time here?
Melissa, those are, in fact, the existential questions of life. I mean, people have spent millennia trying to answer those questions. You were carrying the weight of feeling you were responsible for knowing the answers of those since childhood.
Exactly. Since my earliest days, I pondered those questions. And because nobody could give me the answers, because I couldn't even really verbalize them, much less get the answers, I was left with this utter sense of futility. Like, why am I just going through the motions for no ultimate reason? And why is it so absurd what everyone else is doing?
How did you cope with that early in your life?
Such a great question. I mean, I think two ways. You know, one was I retreated to the vast, boundless expanse of imagination, and that's where all my creativity was. And I did a ton of creative things, dark creative things, but I wrote these rhyming verses from the time I was probably age 3. And I also wrote music, very dark, despairing music, but my imagination was also a beautiful place. I had imaginary friends. It was entirely in my control. But when I had to live here, you know, in the world, I basically ended up denying, repressing, and disassociating from everything I felt and anchoring to achievement, performance, and validation through success.
Tell me a little bit about the poetry that you've written, the verses that you've written over time to express your feelings. I'm wondering if you would feel comfortable reading us something you've written, some short verse.
Absolutely. I mean, I write them every day. And some days, if I'm a little more despairing, I might write 10 in one day. And they're just very simple. But, you know, I was thinking about one sort of for today. And basically, they will not accept our darkness, fearful that it might infect them, when those hiding in the shadows just want others to accept them.
Who's they?
The others, society, the world. You know, it's for the, yeah, for those of us despairing, we feel completely cast aside by society.
I want to invite our listeners one more time, Melissa, because you've been so generous to offer to talk to anybody who might want to call in and share where they've found resources, how they've made it through their journey of anxiety and depression. If that's you, listeners, call 800-423-8255. Melissa, I'm mindful that a minute ago you said part of the way you dealt was working towards success. And you met Doug. The two of you took a huge gamble, launched a new toy company in your basement. You poured your creativity into it, designing, pitching all your toys. I guess I have two questions. You know, one, was that a part of your coping mechanism, or was that a gift that came in meeting Doug, or was it both?
Oh, that's an amazing question. So I guess I know now, and I never believed it and I never associated with it, that I am a creative person. And I think when you're creative in your being, you know, it can channel into a multiplicity of avenues. And I never knew ever that I had the ability to design toys. So I think it was just an accident in both of us deciding to form a toy company that it had the ability to channel into toys. But when it did, it was one of the most extraordinary moments of my life because, you know, I had spent the prior 22 years creating incessantly. I mean, it was my innate form of finding solace, but because that creativity was, as I mentioned, so dark and despairing and never saw light, it never had the ability to give me the meaning I was seeking. But when I realized that I could take that very same anguish that birthed that those dark verses and the dark music and actually channel them instead into toys, something so light and bright that it had the ability to bring children joy, I felt like I could breathe fresh air for the very first time.
And did you do that on your own, or did you have professional help as you made that transition?
Do you mean the help of a therapist?
I do.
Oh, that's an amazing question. So, you know, my facade of perfection basically meant that I could never admit I needed help or was broken. And I didn't even remotely come to the point where I admitted I needed professional help until I truly succumbed to the deluge of emotions that I had been repressing my entire life. And that was in my late 40s. So no, at 22, when we formed Melissa and Doug, I wasn't even remotely close to ever admitting that I needed help or even admitting that I had an issue.
So I might ask you, especially since part of this conversation is that you are now telling your story and wanting to reach out and help others, how did you, I mean, what got you to the point where you knew you needed and wanted professional help and felt ready to avail yourself of that?
Great question. So I was in what I call the feudal race, and a psychiatrist recently told me there's a psychiatric name for it. It's called manic distress my entire life. Because the drumbeat of mortality and that existential despair was so loud and was telling me really that I shouldn't live, that life is futile and just take your life now because it's not worth it in the end. But I didn't want to succumb to it. So I raced away from those thoughts, engaging in continual and incessant activity. And mine was a form of high achievement, right? Creating, birthing children, moving, accessing knowledge, and moving as fast as I could to try to drown out that overwhelming despair. But ultimately, I was in pain. I was resisting the pain with this constant movement. And the suffering became so great that I was, by my mid-40s, I was so exhausted that I started to know that I couldn't do this much longer. And I started to hear, you know, that cry of my own soul to be seen authentically started to get louder and louder until, honestly, I pretty much just succumbed. And I was like, I can't do this any longer. I need help. I can't do it alone. And I need to stop racing, take a breath, and finally take that journey inward and accept myself in totality. And I think, you know, I wrote a verse about that too, because these verses became my mantras. And it was basically, we spend every waking moment chasing answers far and wide when fulfillment is awaiting down the wondrous path inside. And like, I always knew that fulfillment was inside me and that was the only place I was going to find it. Yet I was too terrified to make that journey inward to accept myself.
Are you ready to take a call?
Oh my goodness, am I?
All right. We've got Dennis calling from Worcester. Dennis, go ahead.
Hello. Yep. This is Dennis. Melissa, I just want to thank you for having this discussion publicly and honestly and bravely. I've suffered with depression. I now know my entire life, and while I don't have particular avenues where I found support, particularly this last moment where you discussed that endless race to avoid looking within, as if you're running at the edge of a pit of quicksand.
Yes.
Only in the last 2 years did I realize that I absolutely could not avoid whatever this internal gravity was by chasing change and accomplishment. And it can be lonely and terrible, and without the right friends who treated me like I was not crazy, I wouldn't be in as good a place as I am today. And without people willing to tell their stories as you are, I wouldn't have known, I wouldn't have believed myself that stopping to actually look and examine this wasn't the most dangerous thing I could possibly do.
Yes.
Thank you.
I love what you said, Dennis, and it's so true. And, you know, I took the philosophical path as well as the psychotherapeutic path. And the philosophical path was the first time I didn't feel crazy myself in doing this, because basically the philosophers said that anxiety, or they called it angst, is essential and necessary to go from inauthentic living to authentic living. And when I saw that deep anxiety that I had raced away from was the only way I was going to actually be authentic and find my fulfillment, I knew that I had to jump into that abyss. And that in there was how the only way I would find my truth.
So Melissa, I want to talk now in our remaining time. We have a little time left. about what you and Doug are doing now with Lifelines. And I want to acknowledge, you know, you've been tremendously financially successful. Those resources were available to you as you were taking steps to get help. Talk about what you're trying to do with Lifelines and what it can offer those who don't have the same resources.
Yes, and that is why we are doing this, to offer those who are isolated, alone, know that there is someone who cares about them. So lifelines.com is an ecosystem that is entirely free that Doug and I are funding to show people, one, that they are not alone. And I grew up feeling so stigmatized by these feelings that were so dark and these qualities that made me a creative that were so odd that I don't want anyone to feel that way again. So we accept and embrace everyone exactly as they are. Two, we want to show everyone that they all have the capacity within to channel their darkness into light and make meaning. And we all have these sparks of self-expression in our soul that we can kindle and connect with others and find meaning. And then three, as I mentioned, so many of us are engaged in this futile race away from authentic living, authenticity, and away from who we truly are. And it's not until we stop that racing and have that courage to jump into the abyss and ultimately accept ourselves in totality that we will ever find fulfillment or peace. And that journey, I took that journey, that exact journey is the centerpiece of our ecosystem, and anyone can take it, and we offer it entirely free.
So, you know, we have a caller we won't have time to get to, but I do want to bring Mary's thought forward from Andover. You know, we have known that more and more of us are feeling depression and anxiety, having mental health challenges during the pandemic. How are we doing as a public in having this conversation in this moment as we become increasingly aware of our communal mental health struggles?
Well, I mean, I think our mental health system is entirely broken in this country. And I mean, we are just at such a tipping point where the conversation needs to change, the stigma needs to be removed, and we need to support our population if we are going to move forward. And we need to have mental wellness start from the time children are in preschool so that we can build our muscles. And when things happen, like a pandemic, like tragedies in our lives, we're better equipped to deal with them.
Melissa Bernstein is the co-founder of the Connecticut-based toy company Melissa and Doug. Her new company is Lifelines, a free online community for people struggling with mental health. Melissa, thanks for joining us and sharing your story today.
Thank you, Tiziana.
And listeners, if you are listening today and you're struggling, the number for the 24/7 National Suicide Prevention Lifeline is 1-800-273-8255. That's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, Walter Wuthman, and we have help from Stephen Gelman and Hafsa Qureshi. Our engineer today is Marquise Neal. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Tiziana Deering. Join us tomorrow for Radio Boston's Week in Review.